history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some men and women around you that have some pretty incredible stories to tell if you take the time to ask them about it and listen a little bit. And that's what we do each week on this program. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And over the years, when we've talked to wounded veterans of World War II, especially those who served in some of those memorable Pacific battles that you've heard so much about, sometimes you hear them say, "Boy, I was so relieved when I got aboard the hospital ship, the USS Solis." But we've never talked to anybody who was part of the crew on that ship, who served on that ship, who worked with wounded soldiers and Marines. And we're going to have that privilege today with 91-year-old Cecil Blackford of Tehachapi, California. But originally from Sioux City, Iowa. What was that like growing up out in Sioux City?
Oh, it was great. In Midwest there, we had winters, we had the summers, four seasons. I enjoyed it. Everything else, going up through school and all that, it was wonderful. Until I ended up joining the war in 1942, and that's when I ended up getting in the service. I was a little older, I'd reached the 18. Because I missed out in the first, second grade. I didn't know what I was going to school for. I wasn't the smartest guy. So after breaking my leg playing football out in the field, and couldn't go to school, so I had to stay home. And when I went back to school, I didn't realize what I'm for, and my grades from F's or D's, and so I jumped up to A's and B's, so I needed a break.
I guess so. Literally a break of your leg. And, you know, one thing you said, some people might be scratching their head. They're saying, "Well, just because he broke his leg, how come he couldn't go to school?" But it probably wasn't easy to get to school.
No, it wasn't. We had about a mile to walk. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I had half crutches. All I know, it did me good by staying home for a while. And so when I did go back to school, I enjoyed it more. It was good, maybe. That's why I had to go into service like in the 11th grade.
Let me ask you about this. Growing up, before World War II, you're 9, 10, 11 years old. You've got these three brothers and a sister, and it's the Great Depression that we've heard so much about, but most of the people listening right now didn't live through the Depression. They have no idea what it was like. What was it like for you and your family?
Well, I'll tell you what. We ate a lot of beans. A lot of rice. Dad was working. He was delivered ice and that. Mm-hmm. And, of course, ice business flipped over because another one moved in that small town. That was it. But what we had, and at that time, you could buy an ice cream cone for a nickel and a dime for a loaf of bread and all that. And because of the Depression, because of that, he had no jobs. So that's why he got on WPA. They only made $52 a month. Mm-hmm. For all that, but we didn't have best clothes. Our clothes was whatever. We had two pair of jeans, overalls, and one was for good, one was for play. Mm-hmm. And you took care of those, really. That's all there was to it. And shoes might have holes in, and, you know, I went through it, but we appreciate it now when we see the prices of everything now. It was rough, but we didn't notice it. We grew up with that idea. We were not a rich family. We had what we had, and we appreciated it. So now we look back, and we think now, what a difference. How can things change? A 5-cent hamburger, now you pay about $4 or $5 for the silly thing, you know.
Different world.
Oh, yes.
Different world. And there was a day where the world changed. You were 17 years old on December 7th, 1941. You remember that day? Do you remember how you found out about Pearl Harbor?
I was out here working on my bicycle, out in the yard, shining it up, and announced over the radio we had been attacked in Pearl Harbor and everything. That's the first time I heard about it. When that happened, Well, then from there on, everything changed.
How did you see things changing right there where you were? What changed in your town after that?
Well, Bob, my brother, older brother, the draft caught him, so he had to go, but we just took it for granted. And then eventually we moved out of that town, Mobile, into Sioux City, which is 18 miles in. I started growing up, working in school, helping there and making 25 cents an hour sweeping floors and that. And at the same time, I ended up starting to work for F.W. Woolworth dime 5 and 10 cent store, and that was 25 cents an hour.
And you mentioned your older brother Bob being drafted into the service, and later your younger brother Walt would get into the Navy as well. But you and your brother Don both decided to join the Navy in 1942?
Well, Don was going to be drafted,
But
I wasn't. But Fane, my buddy, and him and two or three others I knew going in, and I was so tired working, no end to it, doing homework at night, go to school and work. I got disgusted. I told Dad, I said, I think I should go to the Navy. And Dad said, well, son, I'm not the man to stop you if you think so, whatever. And that way I went in with Don and Payne and those others, and from there on, my life changed.
And did you think that you were going to be able to stay with your brother and your buddies throughout your time in the Navy?
I did not give it a thing. My mother, she was only 44. And when I went to service, that was the last time I saw her, because she died in 44. I was overseas at the time, and all of a sudden I get a letter from the gal who I ended up getting married to after I got out. And she says, I'm very sorry to hear about your mother. I wish I could do something about it. I didn't know. She didn't say. And I waited and waited for another mail call. And then they explained to me she had passed away and everything. So, and that was 44. And so then that was the last I seen. And I didn't hear about that for a month later, because our ship was so busy out there with hauling patients back and forth to different places and everything. And I didn't hear nothing about it until a month later that she was even in the hospital. And I was told that she was asking for Cecil before. Whether she did or not, I do not know.
Yeah. The last time you saw your mother was
way
when
back
you shipped off overseas.
Well, when I went into the Navy, when I said goodbye.
What do you remember about that goodbye?
That goodbye, I seen her in the front room, because she wasn't feeling good. She wasn't able to go down to the train or anything. So I said goodbye to her then. You know, so long, see you later.
So they ship you up to Chicago and Great Lakes Naval Training Station, and you're there with your brother and your buddies. Did that make it easier to have those guys around, or was it still tough on you?
Nah, it might have made. We had Christmas at that time together. Don and I would be together at the holiday, and it worked out fine as far as that goes.
You're in the Navy. You're at Great Lakes. You go through boot camp and all that. At what point do you get directed toward being a corpsman? Was that your choice or somebody else's?
That was more or less. When we went through our boot camp and everything, they had the questionnaire came around asking, what is your preference? And they said there was a need of medical men. And it happened to be that my brother got the same thing too, and he happened to put in for medical himself.
But so you made the choice. So your brother's continuing in Corps school to learn about how to be a medical corpsman in the Navy. And you decided you were ready to go overseas right now. No way.
Oh, yeah. I was ready to go wherever they sent me.
So you volunteered to go overseas.
Well, he said, what'd you do that for? I said, Don, I joined the Navy to see the world, not to see Great Lakes and all that. I was sent to Treasure Island. From Treasure Island, my orders came out, and I'm shipped over aboard the Solis hospital ship. And there I worked in ward for a while, but then I got the opportunity to go to the operating room and work there. And I went up there, and that's where I spent the rest of my time, where sometimes we worked many, many hours straight without because when we go on the island and pick up these patients, we'd pick them up. Our ship held 600 patients. And when they came aboard, we didn't know where. When we started working on them and everything else, we didn't know when we could quit.
Mm-hmm.
And once we were loaded, we were on our way with a load of patients to be sent to someplace, one of the islands further back. We get rid of them, load up supplies, pull anchor, go back. And we hit many, many, many islands out there. Because we hit the islands of Guam, Saipan, Tinian, Okinawa, Iwo Jima,
right,
New Guinea, New Zealand, Australia. Our ship was back and forth. We were busy going back and forth all the time.
Right.
When I first got on board, the ship was so loaded, they didn't have a bunk for me. So I had to go down, and they had to be places where the jail, more or less. And so that was my bunk for a while until they got rid of patients for me to be able to get up and get a bunk.
So you spent some nights in jail is what you're telling me.
Yeah, might as well have spent a few nights in jail. I had a private room for a while, you know, which I didn't mind a bit.
I'm guessing most people listening have never been on a hospital ship. You mentioned the patient load. You know, 600 patients at a time.
That's right.
It's a pretty big ship.
It is. It's a good size. Iroquois. It was formerly, it was used as a kind of a halfway luxury liner, a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But they had to take it back and restore it, rip out this, rip out that, and make it. Because if we had two surgical operating rooms and we had lab and everything, we were equipped to do anything, whatever required of us to do. It worked out fine. Dr. Cole and Dr. Neal was my main doctors I worked under with in the orthopedic department at West Real Nice. Wesley Robang, he and I worked together as a team on that third table. We would do other surgicals, but not too many. We kept us with the orthopedic, where we did a lot of the legs and everything, amputating legs and arms and putting casts on.
In thinking about that, I'm just trying to imagine myself in your shoes. You're in the operating room as they bring in these guys who've been hit by machine gun fire, blown up by mines, by artillery shells, booby traps, all kinds of things that they encountered on those islands. How difficult was that to see these young men in those kind of conditions?
It got, after a while, they were just another number.
Mm.
We had to do what we did, and that's it. I've seen a time where one of them died on our table because operation didn't. He said before he went in there, don't take me in there. I'm going to die, I'll die. And he did.
Mm.
He died, and that was it. So, I mean, you get used to it. You just don't think when you do it. And hurry up, we got to get through. The quicker we get done, the quicker you can get off this table. I mean, that was the doctor's orders, so you didn't diddle that around,
right.
Be nervous. You just.
Well, I imagine time was pretty crucial because there were a lot of guys waiting for their operation, for
right.
What they needed.
Yeah, when they brought me in, a lot of times they have a corridor. If they were due to go into special for treatment or something like that special, it'd be in a corridor, and you didn't quit until that corridor was all cleared out. When the operation was done, cleaned up, you hurried up, cleaned up, and straightened up, picked up the blood and plaster, because your core, a lot of orthopedic, clean it up, and then you have another one coming to take its place. You just did it.
What's the longest you think you went without a break?
We went 30-some hours one time there without sleep.
More than 30 hours straight of operating in there.
Right through on the table. We were
wow.
So tired that at that time, I was tired, was through. And I went out and sat on the deck, on the floor, the ground, looking out. And at that time, it seemed like there's two battleships swinging in shells into it. Seemed like it was a Guam. And first thing, no, I passed out. And when I woke up, daylight, and I thought, oh, my God, am I going to be in trouble? I thought, left. And I went inside, took a look at the operate in the room, surgical room he's working in, and it was loaded with plaster on the floor, blood. And it's the only thing I can figure out, we must have caught up with a load on at that table, and they must have said, forget it, take off, go to bed, or do something. I don't know. I didn't ask questions, because all I know is I was tired. I sat down, and I passed out like a light.
Right on the deck of the ship.
Right on the deck of the ship, yeah. And I thought I had it.
Good thing you guys didn't hit two stormy seas. You know, you might have gone right overboard.
Oh, yeah, right. There. Yeah.
Then he would have had quite a different story to tell. But we haven't heard half of his story yet. Coming up, the things that he saw in the orthopedic operating room aboard the USS Solis, and the times that that hospital ship, which was supposed to be immune to enemy attacks, was almost sunk by explosives. You'll find photos and videos featuring Mr. Blackford at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 91-year-old Cecil Blackford of Tehachapi, California, originally from Mobile, Iowa. He served as a Navy corpsman during World War II and the Korean War. When we left off, he was discussing his World War II duty aboard the hospital ship USS Solis, which evacuated thousands of wounded soldiers and Marines from the bloodiest battles in the Pacific. And I do want to warn you that we may get into some discussion about the scope and nature of the injuries that Cecil saw up close and personal. If you're squeamish, there may be a moment or two that might not be your cup of tea. Just a heads up. And Mr. Blackford, you told us how exhausting this could be, stretches of more than 30 hours without a break. But can you give us a taste of what your duties were as an operating room technician?
When we got our table, we had to strip them and set them up and whatever that stuff was, get that all stripped up. We had to set up our instruments table, and that's when we had our mask and everything else on. Mm-hmm. And then we had to pass the instruments to the doctor as they needed them. Because some of our cases, they had cut from top by their chest all the way down to the top part of the leg. We've had them so bad that they had to be treated, everything washed out with saline and everything else, and bandaged up, everything else. And so it was up to us to be able to pass the instruments to the doctor as they called for them. Mm-hmm. Then afterwards, naturally, clean them all up, sterilize them, get them ready for the other, but we always had extra packs, all sterilized, ready to go in action immediately anyway. But it was very good. They called Wes and I the torture department. When we come through, we were to torture, because when you put those guys in straps and stretch them and for and bones and all that, why, you didn't pay attention. If they hollered or said anything, that's tough. Because like the doctor said, hurry up, the quicker you get this here done, the better off.
So part of your job, you get a stretcher or a gurney that's got a wounded Marine on it, and you've got to tie him down so he can go through the operation without compromising it.
Well, someone along the line has taken him and put him in.
Yeah.
And he might be on a stretcher in, you know, waiting to go next on. If you had a case on it, you had to finish that their part. Mm-hmm. But the ortho surgical part, they would naturally have to go to maybe something more serious to want to get. You had three table, 1, 2, and 1, 3. You had three different operating tables with the lights and everything above.
Right. But part of your job was tying these guys down.
Oh, yeah.
And not caring if they scream in pain or tell you to stop.
More or less.
That's just what you had to
do. They get a shot, spinal injection, or else they had an anesthetist. She was a woman nurse. It was up to her to handle the putting them to sleep or whatever. And then the doctor would take over, and you'd just be scrubbed up, and you would just assist them. Everything else, you just did accordingly. Sometimes then you had to put the plaster all the way around, you know, body cast. Yep. Which would be way down below their knee on one, and the other one up above by their hip. That was it. Because they would only be aboard our ship 7 or 8 days. By that time, we'd be pulled in into someplace where they would be taken off and used for further there, or maybe a lot of them then would be transferred. Maybe they flew them, certain cases, back to states or wherever.
So I think people are getting the picture that the purpose of this ship is not to be a long-term care facility. It is, in the short term, you're saving some lives and you're passing them off to a hospital where they can recover. So you got a lot of guys coming in and out, and then you guys are always moving to go pick up new crews.
Right.
You probably couldn't even imagine how many people total you guys treated on that ship. Because of how fast they were coming in and out,
they were coming out pretty fast. We had a trip and last, like I said, it was not a hospital. Ships are much larger in how many get on them.
And you said that eventually the patients you're working with were just another guy, another number. But was it always like that? At the beginning, did you feel some of that pain and agony as you watched them going through what they were going through?
Oh, and some of them, yes. Some of them you can't help but feel. We had one guy so stripped down and everything else, and about 10, 11 days, he was aboard our ship, he was on his own, and we'd ask, and finally one day, all of one sudden, we think he's really going to pull through, and all of once they said, well, so-and-so, surgical one, passed away last night, or something like that. You know?
Yeah.
And so sometimes they'd be so stripped and so ripped apart, like I got pictures of showing the wounds that we worked on that table, showing where they was ripped apart in different places and everything else.
There is an emotional toll of that job weighs on you.
Oh, yeah. I don't forget. A lot of those, I see them. But we worked together as a team. Mm-hmm. Our ship crew, we just got along great. And our ship had been bombed one night. They missed the bomb come off our fantail. Luckily, some kamikaze, when they said set condition one, all hands. At that time, the bomb, you feel the ship was rattling all over the place. You knew it and couldn't believe it because hospital ships supposedly went out and lit up like a hospital, like a big city.
Yeah.
Because Japs were supposed to observe them, same as we were supposed to observe their hospital ships.
So you're working? And you feel the impact?
Well, at the time when it happened, we were sitting in the WENT, ear, nose, and throat ward. We were sitting in that operating room. We were talking, writing a letter, just talking, you know. And when it hit, when that bomb struck and hit, we were just shaking all over the place. And then we had put up iron braces on the windows. And everything, the lights went out, I guess, and then they changed their course.
So it didn't hit you, it hit near you, but you guys could feel the...
The fantail is just, if there had been a little bit more, we had patients aboard. You can imagine if that would have struck that ship, it would have been a really catastrophe.
Yeah, it would have been a great tragedy, and it was probably something you hadn't really thought about before?
No, we just took for granted. We took for granted we had a safe, you know, whatever.
You thought your markings and the fact that it was clearly a hospital ship would protect you, and now all of a sudden that's not true anymore.
We found out because at the same time the Comfort got hit too, right around about that time. So I guess they decided that time, forget it. I don't know. They just give up because they more or less started against your safety. So we had to end up with a destroyer escort, two of them, following way behind us.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, if those that weren't on duty had to go down and stand watch if they had time to walk, look out for any submarines or anything, you know, anything.
You mentioned photos of some of the wounds and injuries that you guys dealt with. Can you paint a picture for us? Some of the kinds of injuries that you guys saw, that you guys tried to help with in this operating room?
Missing legs.
Yeah.
Different shoulders and different places where they are wounded. It's up to us to dress them and everything else.
You've been on an honor flight, right?
Oh, yes.
You've been to the National World. And I'll ask you about that in a bit. But, you know, there at the Wall of Gold Stars, representing 406,000 Americans who died in World War II, it says, "Here we mark the price of freedom." A lot of VA hospitals, if you go to it, there's a sign above the door. It says, "The price of freedom is visible here." And I'm just thinking about you in those situations. I mean, if you want to talk about the price of freedom and the guys that are paying something for it, you're looking at them on a daily basis, guys that whose lives are going to be forever changed because of these injuries. Are there maybe an example or two that pop into your mind of injuries that you saw that you thought, boy, that's really bad?
Yeah, a lot of injuries you can see. They were very bad, a lot of them.
What were some of the worst ones that you remember?
The worst one I can remember is one where he's ripped open from here down into the lower part of the leg.
From his chest down to his knee, basically?
I'd say chest down to the base. He was opened up, and his flesh, his stomach was opened up. Where actually, when we changed those air dressings and everything, we had to throw a lot of saline to wash the magnets out. And treat it. I watch that, and that I think of quite often.
Did you ever look at one of these guys and say, "How is this guy alive?"
I'd say, yeah. Well, this guy there, I think he was one after so long a time. He did die. He was cut. We thought he was going to pull through. He did not pull through. One of the other things that bothers that happened, Captain Peterson, the nurse, and myself, we were talking in ENT ward, and all of a sudden the ship just listed way over, and boy, we ran out. We looked over the railing at Dick, and there was a great big mine, all those things sticking out. Mm-hmm. And happened to be Bob Robidoux. I owe my life to him. He's the one that spotted that mine. And I forget what the guy's name that managed to do something through the ship or do something. It managed to go around that mine, and we would look out and see this. Boy, if he hadn't seen that, we would have hit that mine with all it loaded down with patients. You can imagine what would happen. Mm. So now I'm hoping we have a reunion coming up, and I'm hoping able to make it, and I hope he is still living. I figure when I see him, I owe my life to that guy.
Have you had the chance to thank him before?
Oh, yeah. I had a reunion down at San Diego. I was host of the reunion. I got up and started talking, and I brought it before all of them that this man, that he was the one that noticed that mine and saved us. Mm-hmm. And you know, he told me, he said later on, you know, I never said much to anybody on that, but he says that was the first time I had recognized it and brought it out and tried giving him credit for what that was. But that was the two things I remembered, with common cause, bombing, missing, and this mine. Those two of all the time, years, that was the main thing.
Those were the close calls for you.
Right.
But your daily job, your everyday existence, was dealing with guys who had really close calls that would have killed them if you guys weren't there to help save them. So I'm just thinking about you saying, this guy saved your life. There's a lot of guys out there that came home from the war saying, you and those doctors and the people on the Solus helped save their lives.
I had one occasion. I was going down the street in San Francisco on one of my liberties, and I looked down, and this guy hollered, "Hey, Blackie. And, you know, I went over him, and he remembered. He says, "You saved my life. You've donated blood." Because they were asking for anybody that able to, they'd give us a choice, a shot of whiskey or $25 for that blood.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that was it, that he remembered me in San Francisco, in one of the streets on Liberty.
Wow.
I never did forget that.
I can tell just looking in your eyes right now, that's still a pretty powerful emotional memory for you.
Oh, yeah, see, I wasn't, which bothers me very much. The fact is, I wasn't 21 yet, and bars were not. I might be in uniform. We'd go out and fight, but we couldn't possibly be in a bar legally.
Mm.
And so what he did, he said, come with me. We're going to go in and have a few shots or what. And we went into a bar, and he told the gal there, he says, this is a friend of mine. He's my buddy. He saved my life. He knows that he's not of age, but she says, okay, don't worry, I'll take care of it. And so I was able to stay there until whatever time.
Well, and you bring that up, and that brings a lot of other questions to mind. So here you are. You talked about how exhausting this work can do. I mean, at one point, you're there for more than 30 hours straight working on guys in this room. But they're asking the crew of this ship, the people that serve on it, to donate blood to help save lives. How often did that actually happen? How often did you give blood?
I just did it one time. I mean, yeah. It didn't seem to happen. We had like a blood plasma that we gave in place of blood.
Right.
And we had so much of that. And why they was calling for blood, straight blood, I don't know. But I at that time, I donated some blood.
So it was more of a on-the-spot thing. It was an emergency situation. They needed someone to give the blood.
Yeah, I guess so. They had it handy. Had to have it handy for some cases.
Mm-hmm.
And have to be, that was it. And he noticed it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I'll never forget that one.
And what are the odds of running into him on the streets of San Francisco?
So different. The odds are astronomical. That's be about it. It was just, I couldn't believe it.
And you mentioned the two doctors that you worked primarily with.
Dr. Cole and Dr. Neal, both of them worked mainly on the bones and on that orthopedic table.
Well, I bring that back up because I'm just thinking about what you shared about yourself, about, you know, how tiring this could be and how you guys just had to keep going and going. And then I'm thinking about a surgeon going for that straight. And it's not like there's a bunch of other guys waiting to take over for them. I mean, if there are patients that need it, they have to keep going. What did you appreciate the most about those doctors and what you saw them do?
Well, I saw them do the things they did and work in that way and everything. They were great. As far as I'm concerned, a lot of respect for Dr. Neal and Dr. Cole. And the same as one of the psychiatrists that worked on shock on some people like this. One patient, it's eyes. He couldn't see. He'd been shot. His eyes. And this guy, doctor, put him in his ENT ward. He told him, now, because he knew he should be okay. And he told him, now, I know you can't see now, but I know you'll be able to see, just relax and everything. And they was giving him sodium pentothal, just a shot, not too much. They didn't want him to go to sleep. He said, now, this is it. He talked, he changed his brain, his mind. And first thing you know, before he got through, he was able to recognize different things in that operating room.
Mm.
And he said, what's that man wearing, or this and that, and questions. And we were standing watching this doctor, and they all thought he was a quack. And he said, well, no, he said, you're going to go to sleep. But when you wake up, you're going to be able to see everything. And, you know, when he woke up, he could see. His eyesight came back. And I thought, boy, no one could call him a quack. As far as I was concerned.
Results speak for themselves,
Results. I'll never forget that one, that's for sure.
I think we can all see why you wouldn't. It's break time again, but we're not done with Cecil's story. We'll catch the rest of his World War II experiences, plus what he did during the Korean War, and a more recent mission with Honor Flight Kern County. Check out the photos and video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with Cecil Blackford of Tehachapi, California, one of 4 brothers who all served in World War II. He spent 27 months aboard the historic hospital ship USS Solis, which before he came aboard had been at Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. In fact, the crew of the Solis actually took film footage of the explosion aboard the USS Arizona, and men from the Solis evacuated wounded from the Arizona, the West Virginia, the Oklahoma. All told, the Solis earned 7 battle stars in World War II, caring for thousands of soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines wounded in places like Guam, Saipan, Iwo Jima, and Okinawa. We've heard about Mr. Blackford's duties on the ship and some of the different things that he witnessed, and he also mentioned that his mother passed away while he was serving overseas. I know this is not easy to talk about, but can you share that story with us, what it was like for you when you got that devastating news?
It's awful, because I knew, and what had happened, even the captain had come down later on and seen me, captain of the ship, come down. He said, "I'm very sorry to hear about your mother." And so what I did, which is very appreciative, I told the guy at the treasurer, I had money in the books. I said, "I'd like to have you make a money order out. I was going to send back to Dad to pay for the funeral," because I was real close to my mom, because I told her I was sending money for her to get her teeth fixed or something or other, because she had real bad teeth. Use that money to help do that. She wrote back and she says that Dennis says her gums were so warped in, or it was impossible. So I said, "Well, go ahead and use it. I can see when I come home. I'll see what you got." Well, when I came back, I saw the marker in the grave. I saw.
So many of the veterans I've interviewed over the years talk about their mother being back home, praying that they would come home.
Yeah.
And here, 4 of you boys are in the service. All 4 of you come home from the war, but your mother's not there.
Yeah, right. And Walt, my younger brother, feels so bad, because after Don and I was gone, and he wanted to go and get in the service so bad, he got in, and while he's on his way to where he was boot camp or in some place, that's when Mom died. And so then he felt like he caused Mom to pass away because him going to service.
It's hard.
Yeah.
In terms of your service on the Solis, do you feel like what you did was important?
Oh, yes. I figured, like, we, instead of shooting people, we were saving people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember when the war ended?
Yeah, I was on Liberty in Sioux City. They were whistling, horns were blowing, and all this stuff, and down the street, and everybody else was Casey and I, and somebody else was down on 4th Street. We were walking around, I had my uniform on. Everybody was grabbing everybody, hugging and kissing and all that sort of stuff. So I remember that night. But then they was kicking, telling us to get off the street. I couldn't believe it. We were in uniform. They wanted us to get off the street because they didn't want no troubles.
Right.
How we was going to cause trouble, I don't know.
And we've all seen pictures of New York City on VJ Day and the mass of humanity in San Francisco.
Yeah.
But Sioux City was the same way, huh?
Oh,
everybody
yes.
was finding someone to hug and kiss and party with.
Everybody, you know, it's a pretty wild party.
Well, and I guess the reality is, too, the fact that Japan surrendered saved you from going back over there on the Solus for more wounded, right?
Right. We would have been one of the ships. They had about four of our different hospital ships.
Yeah. But they were going to need every one they could get with casualties they forecasted.
Would have been over.
And then you're out of the Navy, but you're still in the reserves.
Right.
And you're working for Union Pacific Railroad, upholstering all these train cars.
Right.
And then the Navy calls you and says, hey, 3 days, you better be here because you're going to Korea.
Yeah.
Went
down to the meeting, bulletin up there, list of names, and that's when I had to quit my job. And get rid of my car, left my car down in Sioux City.
So you end up for 2 years, based out of Japan, going to Korea back and forth to different assignments with this surgical team. And it kind of sounds a lot like, if anyone's ever watched the TV show MASH, that's kind of what you guys were doing, huh?
Yeah, we worked out of tents.
Uh-huh.
We worked out of tents. We were available for that time. And when we got through with ours, they'd have another group, you know, come in and be up to them.
So they would fly you into these locations?
Oh, yeah. They'd fly us in back here over there.
And how long would you stay?
And we'd probably stay maybe a month, whatever.
Were the injuries you guys were treating similar to what you saw in World War II or different?
Different. We'd be having them come in and treat bandage. We'd have to have duty at night. You know, you go through and check all the wards. Like me, I had night duty, which scared me. And another thing, too, see, ordinarily, corpsmen didn't carry guns.
Right.
But we still had our mask, we still had our gun, and we were supposed to keep our guns with us. And this one night, especially, I decided I better had to go potty, because the tent was off to the side. I go over there, and all of a sudden, I'm looking over in the shadow. It looked just like someone was crouched low, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It looked like to me, and I kept looking and looking and looking, seeing if it's going to move or whatever, you know. It bothered me. I was scared. I got out. It was just the moon up there, reflection, making it look like somebody was crouched over there. So I made sure I didn't go middle of the night. And in boot camp, you weren't in there long enough. I had 1 day at the armory. 1 day, that's it. We're supposed to learn how to take that M2 rifle off apart, work it and shoot it, everything else. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are, carrying a gun, ammunition, no experience. It's crazy. It's just funny. But they didn't. They needed Carmen so much, they just rushed them through.
When you're talking about World War II and your time on the Solus, you talked about how nonstop it could be, and how if you had a corridor full of patients, you had to keep going until they were all through.
Oh, you went.
What about in Korea? How did that dynamic play out
there? Well, we didn't have that much. In Korea, we had some patients. We had the surgical tent, you know, we could go treat them for something or other needed. We didn't do much. They would take the patients and then fly them out someplace.
Right. But as far as your job, it was kind of the same, getting things ready, the same kind of things that you did in World War II?
Yeah, we had to be available to do these different things and whatever.
It was just not as nonstop.
It wasn't a nonstop thing. And it was so hot, I swear up and down, in summertime it's the hottest place in the world, and wintertime, I swear up and down, it's the coldest place.
Mm. When that TV show MASH came out, did you watch it?
Oh, yeah, I enjoyed it. It was.
Was it realistic?
Yeah, more or less. You know, it was more or less comedy.
Yeah.
But I knew from experience, which I had in going down to the other place to see what we went through. It was interesting.
So you get done with Korea. If you had stayed in, I'm sure you would have been sent to Vietnam too, but you get out of the Navy, you go back to work for the railroad, you upholster for trains for Union Pacific and Amtrak until you retire in 1985, and then 20 years later they build this World War II memorial in Washington, D.C. because of guys like you. It wasn't the government that built it, it was World War II veterans donating almost $200 million to make it, and then they come up with this honor flight to fly guys back there, and you got to take an honor flight here in Kern County to Washington, D.C. Yeah. What was that like for you? What'd you get out of it?
Oh, that was nice. I seen a lot of it because I was stationed in Dahlgren, Virginia, which was not too far from Washington, D.C., and I went up to Washington, D.C. for some liberties once in a while. I'd be out there in the process of doing so. I did go out to the Unknown Soldier, and I saw a couple things. But still, I went on this flight, and it was great.
What was the best part of that trip for you?
Best part of that trip was just sit back and relax, and the group going around and seeing the different memorials and the food. The food was delicious. And then when you come back, it was just hundreds of people around clapping, wishing us luck, and all that sort of stuff, you know, which is very interesting.
The World War II memorial specifically, what did you think about while you were there looking at all the different parts of that, the fountain, the pillars with every state, the storyboards about the different elements of the war, some battles where you were with the Solus, and then that wall of gold stars representing
all
those
who
died.
It's good. They keep that up. Now, how long is it going to be able to keep up? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, as long as guys like you are around, they'll keep it going.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us some of your stories. Is there anything that I didn't ask you about that you think we should know?
If I had to do it again, I'd do it again.
Mm-hmm.
I would go back to Navy and follow through. So I had to do it. Here I am, 91, 92, and I could still get up and dance. I slowed down a lot because my legs sort of went, lower back bothers me a little bit. The Lord has been good. The Lord has been good to me, and I figure what I went through, and I've always kept busy because I got myself thinking a lot of times to make myself forget.
Mm.
You know, you ever think I just want to forget and I don't remember a lot. So now when I want to remember something, I have to ask her even what's half the time, what day is this? what day is it? Tuesday, Wednesday, Monday, everything else, you know.
I got one more question for you. I don't know if it's an easy one to answer, but I'd be really interested in your perspective on it. Like you said, you're 91. The Lord's been good to you. You're still dancing. Your brother's still alive. But most of us alive today didn't live through World War II. We don't know what it was like to be where you were, to live through those times. So as one of four brothers who served, as one of 16 million Americans who served during that war, as somebody who saw on a daily basis on that ship these guys who paid a big part of that price with their own bodies, what do you think those of us today need to know and remember about World War II and what all you guys did?
Well, I think it's remember those guys that did willingly give their lives away. If something would have happened, that was it. It was naturally the way, here today and gone tomorrow. You've got to expect it. And I think that the ones that are living yet and can be good health, like I tell Gloria, we're just lucky that we do have pretty good health. And we're just very fortunate to be able to go on, because we don't know what tomorrow is going to be. So just be thankful of what you got. Pray for the ones that are sick, that they will be restored and get back to enjoy whatever time they got left. And thank God that you were able to, in my case, do something instead of shoot up somebody and everything. My job was to preserve life and not take it, not take it away. So I gather I'm pretty fortunate.
And I know we all feel pretty fortunate to have shared this hour with you. Cecil Blackford, 91 years old, of Tehachapi, California. Maybe you'll catch him there at one of their monthly Honor Flight reunion breakfasts. You'll find photos and videos with Cecil online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And you'll also find links to the Honor Flight program, which is happening in your area just like it is in mine. And speaking of, if you happen to be listening on one of our affiliate stations in Central California, join me in welcoming home 65 veterans from their Honor Flight on Wednesday, June 29th at the Fresno Yosemite International Airport. That is 6 o'clock p.m. Wednesday night in Fresno. And if you're hearing this show on one of our other stations in other states, look up the next Honor Flight there and get involved. You won't regret it. Most importantly, sign up the veterans in your life before it's too late. We're out of time on Hometown Heroes today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.